Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl, Holly, and I am back today with another solved murder case to share with you guys. Before I dive into the details of today's case, I do want to mention that next month, the trial for Courtney Clenny is set to begin during the third week of August. This trial was delayed back in April, and it is one that I have been anticipating. I had amazing feedback from when I did my trial recap stuff for the Corey Richens trial, and I think I'm going to probably do something similar with this case as well. Courtney allegedly stabbed her boyfriend Christian Obomselli to death in their high-rise apartment in Florida. Her defense is claiming self-defense, but Courtney was known to be violent towards Christian. If you're not familiar with this case, I will have the link in the description of this episode so you can get all caught up before the trial starts in August. All right, so with that little case update out of the way, I don't have any Patreon shoutouts to give this week, but if you would like to join the Patreon, it's just $2 a month. You will get all of my blabbing without any of those pesky interruptions. Visit www.patreon.com/crimewithholly to join. Okay, so let's get into the details of today's case. Today's episode is on the murder of Chelsea Brooke. Chelsea Brooke was born on January 28, 1992, to her parents Matt and Leonda Brooke. She was the youngest of five children, growing up with four older siblings on the family's farm in a teeny town called Mabee, Michigan. Mabee is located in Monroe County, and to call it a small town would be an understatement. According to the 2010 census, fewer than 550 people called it home. It's the kind of place where everyone knows everyone, neighbors look out for one another, and news travels fast. According to the Detroit Free Press, Chelsea was raised on her family's farm, and by all accounts, she was someone people naturally gravitated towards. Friends described her as kind, optimistic, and caring. She had blonde hair, green eyes, and a smile that people seemed to remember long after meeting her. By the fall of 2014, Chelsea was 22 years old, working at Olga's Kitchen. Like a lot of young adults her age, she and her friends had been counting down the days until one particular event, the biggest Halloween party around. This wasn't just any party. It had been the talk of the summer. Hosted every year by a man everyone knew as Big Mike. These Halloween parties had become something of a local tradition and something that everyone always talked about. People came from all over for live music, dancing, bonfires, and of course, plenty of alcohol and drinking. Big Mike was in a band himself, and they always performed at the event. The party was held on his mother's farm in Newport, Michigan, and if you lived anywhere nearby, this was the Halloween party that you didn't want to miss. Chelsea and her friends had been before, so they already knew what to expect from the night. Every year, several hundred people would show up, and I was actually able to find the original Facebook event for the party that year. It was scheduled for October 25th, 2014, beginning at noon and continuing until 5 a.m. the following morning. The event page described it exactly how you'd expect. It read, quote, "You know how I throw a party, raw and uncut. Ha. There's going to be eight bands plus the shenanigans. BYOB, must be 21 to drink. Free camping, a 40-foot bonfire, for only a $10 parking fee. We encourage everyone to dress up and have the most amazing time of your life. There will be prizes for the top three costumes," end quote. The post went on to advertise food vendors, professional photographers, video production crews documenting the event. That's how big of a deal it was. An MC who would be performing fire breathing, and ended with one simple rule: no fighting. If you do, you'll be kicked out by my security team and myself. Party on, dudes. The event listed every band's performance time, with Big Mike's own band, Pickaxe Preacher, kicking things off. Reading through the event page really paints a picture of just how big this party was expected to be. This wasn't a small backyard get-together with, 10 to 20 people. This was a full-day event with live entertainment, hundreds of guests, professional cameras documenting the festivities, and people traveling from all over to attend. On October 25th, Chelsea headed to the party with her friend, Becky. The two of them planned to be characters from Batman and Robin. Chelsea picked to be the evil character of Poison Ivy. She had spent weeks hand-sewing her costume, carefully covering it with ivy leaves. She paired it with a purple wig that faded into bright red tips at the end. And by all accounts, she absolutely loved how her costume turned out. After arriving at the party, the two friends met up with another friend, Penny, who was about 10 years older than Chelsea. Despite the 10-year age difference between them, Penny and Chelsea were incredibly close. In fact, Penny later said during an interview with Dateline that the two were practically attached at the hip. As the night went on, around midnight, the massive bonfire was finally lit, drawing a large crowd of people to the center of the party. While Chelsea was walking over with Becky and Penny, she somehow managed to smack her nose on a tent pole. And I think we've all accidentally hit our nose on something before. It is not a great feeling. You instantly tear up, your eyes are watery. It's just kind of miserable whether you get a bloody nose or not. After that happened, Chelsea was pretty much over the party and she just wanted to go home. I think she was kind of pissed off, upset, sore, just over it. But her friends encouraged her to stick around a little longer. They told her to have another drink, that she would start feeling better soon, and eventually she did. So the night continued. Earlier that evening, everyone had already decided that when it was time to leave, Chelsea would ride home with Penny. Around 1 a.m., Penny decided it was probably time to head out. Her sister, who had also attended the party, had to be at work the following morning, and she had to get up at 6 a.m., so they needed to get going. The problem was, Chelsea was nowhere to be found. Unfortunately, they couldn't just call Chelsea to see where she went. Becky had been holding onto Chelsea's cell phone all night because her Poison Ivy costume didn't have any pockets. With several hundred people spread across the property, searching for one person was nearly impossible. Penny's sister was anxious to get home so she could get a few hours of sleep before work. And after looking around without any luck, they made the decision to leave without Chelsea. They figured that she knew plenty of people at the party and would eventually run into someone she recognized who could give her a ride home. So they left. Unfortunately, that also meant Chelsea was left behind without her phone. The following morning, Becky woke up and realized that she still had Chelsea's cell phone. Thinking nothing was seriously wrong, she called Chelsea's mom and left a voicemail asking her to let Chelsea know that she could pick it up whenever she wanted. It wasn't until later that day that Becky received a Facebook message from Chelsea's sister saying that Chelsea never made it home. Becky initially wasn't too alarmed. She replied that Chelsea was probably just at a friend's house sleeping off a hangover from the crazy party. But as Sunday turned into Monday, there was still no sign of Chelsea. No phone call, no text message, no one had heard from her. And that was completely out of character. At that point, Chelsea's family reported her missing and immediately began trying to piece together what had happened. They contacted everyone that they could think of who might have seen her that night, including the man who hosted the party, Big Mike. Mike later said in a Dateline interview that he didn't even know who Chelsea was when he received the message from her sister. But as soon as he learned that someone was missing, he agreed to search his property. While walking around the grounds, his dog got caught in a fox trap, forcing him to stop the search and head back to his house. When he returned home, he found Chelsea's family gathered at the property. According to Mike, Chelsea's mother was immediately suspicious of him. And honestly, that's understandable. This is a worried mom. Her 22-year-old daughter had vanished without a trace after attending a party on his property. She was terrified and desperately searching for answers and desperately searching for anyone to blame. Mike recalled that she asked him direct questions, including whether Chelsea was being held in a basement or locked inside one of the trailers on the property. Before leaving to take his dog to the vet, Chelsea's family had essentially made the property their base of operations for the search. Mike later said they never asked permission and, unsure of what to do, he contacted his attorney. His attorney advised him to simply let them continue searching and not to interfere. Meanwhile, law enforcement arrived with ATVs, search dogs, and search teams. They thoroughly searched the property but found no trace of Chelsea. As the days went on, the search expanded far beyond the party grounds. Some of Chelsea's friends feared she may have tried walking home and had been struck by a passing vehicle, ending up injured in a ditch somewhere. Others worried about something even more sinister. There had recently been reports in the area involving women who had been abducted and forced into sex trafficking, and some feared Chelsea may have been another victim. For investigators, one of the biggest challenges after those initial searches came up empty was figuring out where to look next and who to talk to. Now, keep in mind, this wasn't some small house party where investigators could simply make a list of everyone who attended and interview them one by one. This was a massive event where easily over 600 people were in attendance. And even though the party was held on Big Mike's property, he didn't personally know everyone who showed up. And investigators were dealing with one more major obstacle. This wasn't just any party. It was a Halloween party. Hundreds of people were wearing wigs, masks, makeup, and costumes that could easily disguise what they actually looked like. Trying to identify someone based on witness accounts was going to be incredibly difficult, if not impossible. So despite not really knowing where to begin, investigators started with what they did know. They decided to try to get to know who Chelsea was in hopes to get a better understanding of what may have happened. They searched her bedroom, went through her phone, and interviewed the people who knew her best, including Becky and Penny. One of the first things they wanted to know was whether Chelsea had been seeing anyone. Did she have a boyfriend? Was she interested in someone? They learned that Chelsea was single, although there were a few men that she had been interested in. Naturally, investigators looked closely at each of them, but one by one, they were ruled out. As the investigation continued, detectives were eventually able to locate at least six different people who had seen Chelsea after her friends left the party. Several of those people told investigators that Chelsea had asked to borrow their phones. One of the calls she made was to Penny. By that point, Penny had already left the party. Penny later told Dateline that she said no when Chelsea asked for a ride. She said that at the time, she felt like she was being responsible saying no because she had drank too much and didn't want to get behind the wheel. She also said Chelsea didn't sound upset, panicked, or desperate. Nothing about the conversation stood out as unusual, but other witnesses painted a very different picture. Several people recalled seeing Chelsea near the bonfire crying. They said that she was upset because her friends had left without her. She reportedly told people that she didn't have any friends, that she had been ditched, and that she had no way to get home. One detail investigators found especially interesting was that despite borrowing multiple people's phones throughout the night, Chelsea never once called her mother. Then, a few days after Chelsea disappeared, investigators received what would become one of the most significant tips in the case. The call came from a mother of a young man who had attended the party. Her son told investigators that around 3:30 that Sunday morning, he distinctly remembered seeing Chelsea. He was certain it was her because he had complimented her poison ivy costume and joked that he was allergic to poison ivy. He described Chelsea as visibly intoxicated, but she wasn't alone. He told investigators that there was a man lingering around her. According to the witness, the man seemed to be comforting Chelsea, standing close to her as though they knew each other. Eventually, he watched as Chelsea and the unidentified man walked away together into the darkness. The witness provided investigators with a detailed description, and working with a sketch artist, they created a composite sketch of the man he believed he had seen with Chelsea. Investigators released the sketch to the public almost immediately, and tips poured in. The problem was, the sketch depicted someone who looked incredibly ordinary. He resembled countless men. In fact, several people thought he looked like members of one of the bands that had performed at the party. Investigators chased every lead that came in. The FBI even assisted in looking into those band members to determine whether Chelsea may have left with them after the party. But every lead came back the same. Nothing. No connection. As the investigation continued, Chelsea's family couldn't shake one particular feeling. They believed Big Mike knew more than he was saying. Investigators brought him in for questioning, and he fully cooperated. He told detectives that he didn't personally know Chelsea. However, when investigators asked for permission to search his property, he refused, so they obtained a search warrant. According to Mike, roughly 13 SWAT officers arrived at his property and searched his home from top to bottom. Investigators also spent a considerable amount of time digging through his burn pit, hoping to uncover anything that could explain what had happened to Chelsea. But after an exhaustive search, they found absolutely nothing linking Chelsea to the property. Even so, investigators weren't quite ready to eliminate Big Mike from their radar. They continued pursuing every lead they could while keeping him in the back of their minds as a person of interest. It wasn't long after investigators searched Big Mike's property that another tip came in. This time, the tip centered around a young man named Harlan Bird. According to the caller, Harlan likely knew what had happened to Chelsea, or at the very least had information about where she might be. Investigators quickly brought him in for questioning, and Harlan told detectives that he had witnessed two men harassing a young woman in the parking area of the party. He claimed that they were shoving her around while she screamed for help. According to Harlan, he stepped in, fought the men off, and helped Chelsea back to her feet. He even told investigators that she'd been bleeding and that some of her blood had gotten on his shirt. Harlan said that he didn't want to leave Chelsea alone, but he also was worried that if anyone saw him standing there with an injured woman, they might assume that he was the one who assaulted her. So instead, he claimed that he placed Chelsea in the back seat of a four-door red car. The problem was, he said he had no idea whose car it was. He told investigators that he walked back to the party to find someone who knew Chelsea, and after about 10 to 15 minutes, he returned to the parking lot. By then, both Chelsea and the car were gone. It was certainly an interesting story, and the investigators weren't buying it one bit. It seemed just so random and so unlikely. So they began pressing Harlan with more direct questions. Did you assault Chelsea? Did you rape her? Did the two of you have sex? Harlan denied every accusation. Then investigators asked him one simple question that completely unraveled his story. Harlan, did you even know Chelsea? Did you even see Chelsea that night? Again, no. He finally admitted that he had fabricated the entire story, and what a waste of time. His explanation was that he simply wanted to make himself look good. Unfortunately, that meant investigators had wasted valuable time trying to determine whether any part of his story was true. Harlan was ultimately arrested for lying to police. But even after admitting that he had made it all up, investigators weren't quite ready to completely dismiss him. Like several others before him, they kept his name in the back of their minds as the investigation continued. Months passed with little progress. Then in late March, another phone call came in. This one came from a woman named Cheryl Retzlaff. Cheryl lived just 2.8 miles from the farm where Big Mike's Halloween party had taken place. She told investigators that while cleaning up debris left behind after the winter, she had come across a single shoe. At first, she didn't think much of it. She explained that because their property sat along a well-traveled road, people were constantly tossing things out of their vehicles. Finding random items wasn't unusual. She'd found everything from spare tires and speakers to old car radios. This time, though, it was a red leather flat. Without giving it much thought, Cheryl tossed it into the trash with the rest of the debris she collected. Later that evening, when her husband got home, he asked her what she had found while cleaning. As Cheryl listed off the different items, she casually mentioned the shoe. And it was her husband that actually said to her, "What if that's Chelsea's shoe?" So they called it in, and deputies came out to collect the shoe. The following day, detectives showed a photograph of it to Chelsea's mother, and she immediately identified it. It belonged to Chelsea. Investigators quickly organized another large-scale search of the surrounding area. Ground crews searched on foot, aircraft searched from above, but despite the extensive effort, they found nothing else connected to Chelsea. Then another discovery would completely change the investigation. There was a man named Eric who lived in Monroe County, and to earn extra money, he and a friend regularly went scrapping. If you've never heard of scrapping, don't feel bad because I hadn't heard it called that either, but it's basically searching abandoned properties or vacant lots for scrap metal and other items that they could sell for cash. Eric said that money was tight, so this was something that he often did. One day, the two men entered an abandoned building located about 10 miles from Big Mike's property. As they searched through piles of junk, they flipped over a rotting sheet of plywood. Underneath, they noticed what appeared to be a fake plant. But when they bent down for a closer look, they realized it wasn't a plant at all. It was a poison ivy costume. Lying nearby was a purple wig. Not realizing the significance of what they'd found, they tossed everything back to where it had been, finished looking around, and left the building. About a week later, Eric was at work when he happened to see a missing persons flyer for Chelsea Brooke. And on that missing persons flyer was a photograph of Chelsea wearing her poison ivy costume. The moment Eric saw it, everything clicked. The costume he and his friend had found inside the abandoned building wasn't just some discarded Halloween outfit. It could have belonged to the missing woman everyone had been searching for. But instead of immediately calling police, Eric hesitated. He was terrified. He worried that because he had touched the costume, investigators would somehow think that he was involved in whatever happened to Chelsea. He eventually confided in his sister over brunch, explaining what he had found, and she didn't hesitate. She basically told him, "If you don't call the police, I will." So Eric picked up the phone and he called. Investigators responded immediately and recovered the costume from the abandoned building. During their examination, they discovered that the straps and the crotch area of the costume had been ripped. And of course, exactly what Eric had feared ended up happening. He was brought in for questioning. Detectives wanted to know if he knew Chelsea, whether he attended the Halloween party, and how he had just happened to stumble across such a crucial piece of evidence. Eric explained that he had never met Chelsea and he hadn't even been at the party. In fact, he said that he had spent the entire weekend at home with his daughter. He voluntarily provided investigators with his fingerprints and a DNA sample, and after everything was examined, Eric was ruled out. But the discovery of the costume led investigators to another interesting connection. When they looked at the location of the abandoned building, they realized it was extremely close to the home of someone they'd already interviewed. Harlan Byrd, Remember Harlan? He's the man who fabricated the story about rescuing Chelsea from two men in the parking lot. As it turns out, Harlan lived about 100 to 200 yards from the abandoned building where Chelsea's costume had been found. Naturally, investigators wanted to speak with him again. This time, Harlan arrived with an attorney. Detectives questioned him about the building and asked why Chelsea's costume had ended up so close to where he lived. Harlan admitted that he had been inside the abandoned building before, but insisted he had no idea how Chelsea's belongings got there and denied having anything to do with her disappearance. He also agreed to provide a DNA sample and submit to a polygraph examination. Ultimately, investigators said his DNA did not match the evidence. He passed the polygraph, and once again, they ruled him out. Then, on April 24th, 2015, nearly 6 months after Chelsea disappeared, a shocking discovery would finally bring answers. About 7 miles from the Halloween party, a dump truck arrived at a rural construction site to deliver fill dirt for a new home that was being built. As the driver backed into the property, the truck became stuck in the mud. He climbed out to see what had happened, and that's when he saw it. A body. The property owner immediately called 911, telling dispatchers he believed the body might belong to the young blonde woman whose missing posters had been displayed all over town. Honestly, the timing of this discovery almost felt like fate. Had that dump truck not gotten stuck in the mud at that exact moment, the body likely would have been buried beneath thousands of pounds of fill dirt. There's a very real possibility that Chelsea may have never been found. Investigators discovered that the body had been partially concealed beneath logs and tree branches in what appeared to be a hurried attempt to hide it. Nearby, they also located a single artificial ivy leaf from Chelsea's costume. Before any of this was released to the media, investigators went to Chelsea's family's home, and they told them that a body had been discovered, and while they were still waiting for official confirmation, investigators told them that they were fairly certain that it was Chelsea. The following day, dental records confirmed their fears. The body belonged to Chelsea Brooke. Not long after Chelsea was identified, investigators received another important call. The forensic laboratory had completed examination of the poison ivy costume. Inside the costume, analysts recovered Chelsea's blood, but they also found DNA from an unidentified male. That DNA profile was entered into CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System, which is the national DNA database law enforcement used to compare DNA profiles from criminal investigations against known offenders and other crime scene evidence. They also used this sample to compare it to the two men who had been close to the scene where Chelsea's costume had been found. And both Eric, who found the costume, and Harlan, who lived near the abandoned building and had said that he helped Chelsea that night, were officially 100% cleared. Their DNA was not a match. At that point, investigators went back to the beginning. Anyone they had interviewed early in the investigation was asked to provide a DNA sample for comparison, and one of those people was Big Mike, and once again, he refused. Mike later talked about the decision during an interview with Dateline. He said his attorneys advised him that he wasn't legally required to provide a DNA sample, so he chose not to. He also admitted that he was frustrated. From his perspective, investigators kept coming back to him, and he felt like they still believed that he had something to do with Chelsea's disappearance and now her murder. He said he simply wanted to move on with his life. About a month after Chelsea's body was discovered, the medical examiner released her cause of death. Chelsea had died from blunt force trauma to the head. Then, roughly 10 months after her body was found, investigators got another unexpected phone call. It was from the owner of the property where Chelsea had been discovered. While doing more work on his land, he had found another one of Chelsea's red shoes. Investigators returned to the property once again, carefully searching the surrounding area. This time, they found another piece of evidence: Chelsea's green tights. Then, finally, the break investigators had been waiting for. The crime lab contacted detectives with urgent news. The unidentified male DNA recovered from Chelsea's poison ivy costume had finally matched someone in CODIS. That name came back as a complete surprise for investigators. It was someone that they had never heard of, Daniel Allen Clay. Daniel lived in Monroe County, but he didn't have a permanent address. He was unemployed and was floating around to various different houses depending on who he was dating. He also had several children. So how did investigators finally get Daniel's DNA? Ironically, because of a brand new law in Michigan, the state had recently begun collecting DNA samples from anyone arrested for a felony. In May of 2016, Daniel was arrested on felony larceny charges. As required under the new law, his DNA was collected and entered into CODIS. The moment it was uploaded, it matched the DNA recovered from Chelsea Brooks' costume. Now that investigators had their first real suspect, the next challenge was finding him. Because Daniel didn't have a permanent address, it took investigators some time to track him down. And during that process, they also learned that he had several outstanding warrants for unpaid child support. Once detectives located the home where he was staying, they set up surveillance. When the opportunity presented itself, they arrested him on the outstanding warrants, not for Chelsea's murder. They didn't even tell him that he was a murder suspect. Then they brought him into an interrogation room. At first, Daniel seemed genuinely caught off guard when detectives started asking him about Big Mike's Halloween party. He told investigators that he arrived sometime between 8 and 9 that evening and left around 10 or 11. When asked if he knew Chelsea Brooke, he immediately said no. He claimed that he had never seen her at the party, never met her, never even heard her name until she became the focus of the media coverage after she disappeared. Investigators then asked him one more direct question. Have you ever had sex with Chelsea? Daniel's answer was immediate. Absolutely not. So detectives followed up with another question. Could there be any reason your DNA would be found on Chelsea or any of her belongings? Again, he said no. That's when investigators revealed what they had been holding back. They told Daniel they already had his DNA and they knew that he was lying. Almost instantly, his story changed. Now, Daniel admitted that he had in fact hooked up with a woman after Big Mike's Halloween party, but he claimed that he couldn't remember who she was. Maybe it was Chelsea, maybe it wasn't, he didn't know. But if it was Chelsea, he insisted the encounter had been completely consensual and that nothing violent had happened. Investigators knew that they needed to keep him talking, so they decided to use a psychological interrogation tactic. They falsely told Daniel that Chelsea suffered from brittle bone disease, which is a condition that causes bones to break much more easily than normal. They suggested that if something had happened between them, maybe her death had been a tragic accident rather than an intentional killing. The truth was, Chelsea did not have brittle bone disease. Investigators made up the entire story, hoping that Daniel would let his guard down and begin filling in the blanks himself. Investigators told Daniel that only they and Chelsea's mother supposedly knew about this medical condition. So they told him that if that was what really had happened, now was the time to tell the truth. The detective later said that the moment he mentioned brittle bone disease, he could almost see the wheels in Daniel's head turning. Daniel started talking about how he had once broken his own hand and began rambling about injuries. If you watch the interrogation footage, it's almost as though you can see him physically relax. Like he suddenly believed investigators were giving him an explanation that could excuse what happened. And that's when his story changed yet again. This time, Daniel claimed that he had been driving down the road when he saw Chelsea walking by herself. He offered her a ride and, according to Daniel, the two began having consensual sex. He claimed Chelsea asked him to choke her and he said that he did. Then, after they switched positions and Chelsea was lying beneath him, she suddenly went limp. Daniel told investigators that he tapped her face, tried to wake her up, and then convinced himself that he must have choked her too hard because of her supposed brittle bone disease. He claimed he attempted CPR, but when she didn't respond, he panicked. According to his story, he got back into his vehicle, drove away, and eventually carried Chelsea's body into a wooded area where he had left her. One thing Daniel could never explain, however, was the costume. He insisted that he had no idea how Chelsea's poison ivy costume ended up inside the abandoned building nearly 5 miles away from where her body was eventually discovered. And despite Daniel giving investigators multiple different versions of what had happened that night, I don't think anyone ever fully got the truth on what exactly happened and why he decided to kill Chelsea. Daniel Clay was charged with Chelsea's murder. Before he was taken to jail, investigators allowed him to make a phone call, and he called the mother of one of his children. And here's one of those incredibly strange coincidences you sometimes see in true crime cases. The woman he called was actually one of Chelsea's co-workers. She had worked alongside Chelsea and Becky at Olga's kitchen before Chelsea disappeared. So while Daniel and Chelsea may not have known one another personally before that night, there was still an unexpected connection between their lives. After his arrest, Daniel pleaded not guilty. His defense maintained that Chelsea's death had been a tragic accident during consensual sex. When the case went to trial, Daniel continued insisting that he had only choked Chelsea for about 20 to 30 seconds before she unexpectedly died. But the medical evidence told a very different story. A forensic pathologist testified that while someone can lose consciousness after roughly 20 to 30 seconds of sustained pressure to the neck, that is not enough time to cause death. To actually kill someone by strangulation, the pressure has to continue for approximately another 2 to 2.5 minutes. In other words, Daniel's explanation wasn't medically possible. Not to mention, Chelsea had sustained blunt force trauma to the head, so where was that in his excuse as to what had happened? Jurors were also shown Chelsea's poison ivy costume turned inside out. The bloodstains inside the costume demonstrated that Chelsea had suffered significant bleeding. Then a textile expert testified that the damage to the costume wasn't consistent with someone simply removing it. Instead, the expert concluded that the fabric in the crotch area had either been forcefully torn or cut with a blunt-edged object. That testimony directly contradicted Daniel's claims that Chelsea had voluntarily removed the costume during consensual sex. On May 16, 2017, after only a few hours of deliberation, the jury reached its verdict. Daniel Clay was found guilty of first-degree murder and concealing the death of an individual. In July of 2017, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Chelsea's mother attended the sentencing wearing purple, Chelsea's favorite color, and a Crime Stoppers pin displaying her daughter's photograph. During her victim impact statement, she addressed Daniel directly. According to Michigan Live, she told him that she forgave him, but forgiveness did not mean forgetting. She also handed Daniel a Bible. Daniel thanked her and said that he would keep it as long as he could and apologized for everything that had happened. The judge, however, was far less receptive. According to Michigan Live, he rejected Daniel's repeated apologies, saying, quote, "I spent 10 days in trial with Mr. Clay, and I listened to countless hours of him changing his story every time detectives questioned him or brought up something new. It is very clear to me, Mr. Clay, you are a liar, a rapist, and a killer," end quote. In 2019, Daniel Clay attempted to appeal his conviction. However, the Michigan Court of Appeals upheld both his conviction and his sentence, ensuring that he would remain behind bars for the rest of his life. And you guys, that is the story of Chelsea Brooke. My heart truly goes out to Chelsea's family and everyone who loved her. I can't begin to imagine the emptiness her loss has left in their lives or the pain they've had to carry every single day since she was taken from them. While nothing can ever bring Chelsea back, I am grateful that investigators never gave up on her case and that the man responsible was ultimately identified, held accountable, and sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison. Chelsea deserved so much more than what had happened to her, and I hope her family has found at least a small measure of peace in knowing that justice was served. Crimesters, make sure that you are a part of my private Facebook group. You can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I post all pictures and information pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. If you want to keep up with what I'm doing in life, find me on Instagram at CrimeaHolly. And if you would like more true crime content, you can find me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. Thank you all so much for spending time with me today. I will see you next time. But until then, always remember to be aware and take care. Bye-bye.